Hello, and welcome to the Logistics Management Podcast Series. My name's Jeff Berman. I'm Group News Editor for Logistics Management Magazine, as well as the Peerless Media Supply Chain Group. It's a real pleasure today to welcome Dr. Walter Kemzes to our podcast. Walter is Principal of the Kemzes Group. If you've heard Walter's name before, it's probably for good reason, as he's one of the leading, if not the leading, global trade economists out there today. Walter is widely viewed as one of the foremost experts on ports, rail, and infrastructure in the United States. His areas of expertise include demand forecasting, maritime, and overall global trade regulatory issues, public and private port and infrastructure financing, and long-term strategic planning and capital investment. Having worked in major cities all over the globe, Walter has a global perspective which uniquely qualifies him as a global trade economist. He also currently advises several major U.S. port authorities and is routinely asked to work on complex issues with various investment banks, private equity firms, and public regulatory agencies. Walter also provides substantial support to the freight movement industry via the publication of port volume data for the American Association of Port Authorities, presentations at major international industry conferences, and he also advises the United States Department of Commerce on supply chain competitiveness. Walter recently testified to the United States Senate Transportation and Commerce Subcommittee on issues affecting the freight industry and has also published research in various scholarly journals. Hey, Walter, welcome to our podcast today.
Good morning, Jeff. It's thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to have you. Why don't we just jump right in, Walter? I mean, it goes without saying, and I know we've talked a couple of times in recent weeks, that these are really unprecedented times when it comes to the supply chain, really given the attention it's received going back to really the onset of the pandemic back in March 2020. But with that as sort of a backdrop, Walter, let's sort of start with the present. And I'm sure we could fill up our entire time with this, to be honest.
But, oh, you know, no kidding.
Yeah. How would you sort of assess really what we're looking at in terms of the state of the global supply chain, giving all these moving parts and challenges? And then we can sort of drill down to some other things from there.
All right, great. So let's break this down into several parts. We have problems originating on the demand side. We have problems originating on the supply side or production side. And then we have two levels of problems with the connection between the supply and the demand side. So we'll start with the demand side first. That's a pretty straightforward thing to see. When you look at retailers' sales, and I noticed that I was careful to say retailer because a lot of economists like to look at retail sales. Yeah, and retail sales includes cars and gasoline and other things that do not come in containers, restaurant meals, etc. So we can put that aside. I don't care about retail sales at the moment. I care about retailers' sales. That's the sales of the big, you know, retail outlets. And basically, they have been running in the last 12 months or so at levels that are 20% higher on average than what they were in the equivalent months in the year of 2019. Mm-hmm. So since the retailers in this country import almost everything that they sell, that means that they have been bringing 20% more containers of goods via ocean carriers from foreign locations into the U.S. And since imported containers are on average 50% of the container volumes handled by a port, that has had a significant impact on the container port volumes over the last 12 to 14 months. And these volumes have been above the level of any previous peak season level of volume. So if you look back to 2019 to 2018, 17, etc., the volume levels have been consistently above what the highest month volumes were in previous years. So that's quite a bit to take in. If you think about it, our industry increases its throughput capacity by 3 to 5% on any given year. Yeah. And so let's just say take 5% as the more robust number. 5% into 20% means that the ports are being pushed. And when I say ports, I really should correct myself and say port gateways are being pushed to handle volumes that no one would have anticipated for at least 4 to 5 years. So we've only had a year of this. Maybe we've increased capacity 5%, but there's no way that the system itself, the entire system, from the waterways to the ports to the road and railways, industrial warehouses, labor training, could have increased its capacity fast enough to meet this kind of demand. So from the demand side, we would have problems. But then you look at the supply side, and you know we have and let's just make up a company here, okay? They sell this company sells products for kids going to school, you know, notebooks, pencils, pens, crayons, whatever, and they normally source from China. Well, China opened, and then it had to parts of China had to shut down, and then reopen, and then shut down again. And in the middle of those shutdowns, the importer would call another country, say Vietnam or India or Indonesia, and try to import it from there. And when they got the run up and running, then that country would shut down. And so you now had to find another place to source your materials from. And that's what it's been like on the procurement side for the retailers. When you finally find a place, a new place to import from, it may or may not be able to supply to you at the right time, simply because they're on this, you know, coronavirus, you know, shut down, reopen. And I have some interesting charts on that at the FuturePorts website, if anybody wants to see. But it's been very tricky. So in the middle of this, we have an increased demand for freight movement, just higher level of throughput. And we also have a higher variance imposed on the freight movement industry. And both of these require a lot more equipment in order to do. So what I mean is that, you know, if you're putting 20% more through the system, then you have to increase the number of ships and containers and trucks and trains in a proportionate manner just to meet the higher volume, which is what we've been doing for the last 10 years with those 3 to 5%, you know, increases in the capacity of the system. But this was quite a big jump. But the other problem is, even if we didn't have a 20% jump in demand, we still would be short equipment because the amount of equipment we had was set by the patterns of freight movement and by the cadence of the seasonality, the seasonal peaks, the cycle. And you know, on average, we have enough to meet demand, and we try not to end up with too much empty equipment piling up in one place or another. And the system was set up to move things as efficiently as possible. But once the variance starts to rise, once you're putting equipment into different trade lanes than it normally gets assigned to because, you know, you had to shift from China to Vietnam or India to get your crayons, you now need more equipment because that equipment won't migrate back to its regular route when the other country opens for quite some time. And I've experienced this as, you know, being part of a company that moved, you know, freight in 53-foot containers. And when coronavirus picked up, the amount of equipment needed in order to meet the demand was increased by 3 times. And, you know, we just couldn't cope with it because when we went to find more equipment, so did everybody else. And the ability to produce equipment is limited. So that's the overall picture. But okay. But it's not the crux of the problem.
Yeah, no, there's so many moving parts here, and you did a really good job of setting the table there, Walter. And just in terms of timeliness, now that we're halfway through the month of October, which in, you know, a normal environment is often considered sort of the busiest, if not one of the busiest months of the year, as it relates to gearing up for the holiday shopping season. stands to reason that not much will be normal about this year's holiday shopping season, especially even the mainstream media has really picked up on it. Get your holiday shopping done early. The ports are clogged. There's all kinds of issues. I mean, there's a lot to chew on there. What are your thoughts on the 2021 peak season? I mean, just on the surface, it stands to reason it could really be unlike anything we've been through in the past.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I'm so disappointed with the mainstream media because they're always instigating panic buying. When I lived in New York, I hated it when I was in Manhattan in the middle of the day and the news came out that we're about to have a snowstorm. You know, the weather forecasters can't predict anything until the last minute, right? So by the time I managed to jump on the train and go to where I lived in New Jersey, and then jump in my car and drive to the supermarket. The supermarket was bare. All you had was the lowest quality bottled water. You know, and there was nothing there except for maybe weird stuff like, you know, garlic flavored peanut butter or something like that. And nothing. So I was glad when I moved to Savannah because I thought, well, I won't have that problem anymore. But now we've got the news guys happy to jump on, you know, to the weather forecast and talk about hurricanes. And it's a little worse here because it's not as frequently restocked as it was where I lived in New Jersey. So when the weather person says hurricane, an hour later I get to the store, it's bare too. So, you know,
yeah.
But it's the same problem right now. You know, what did not help the situation at all were comments back in early September about how you need to do your Christmas shopping now or you won't have anything. So instigating panic shopping is probably the worst thing the mainstream media does, you know, for our economy and in particular for the logistics industry.
Mm-hmm.
But but to me, I'm going to turn, you know, just switch around here a little bit, Jeff. To me, the fundamental problem is the truck drivers. What's interesting is when I look at the retailers, you know, again, retailers, not retail, but retailers, you know, inventories. The last data point I've seen has the inventories down to 2016, 2017 levels. So that's very, very low. Meanwhile, when you look around the port cities, the vacancy rate for industrial real estate, you know, within a 20 to 30 minute drive from the ports, not miles, because I don't know what miles mean when I compare a congested city like Los Angeles with a less congested one like Mobile. But when I look at 20 to 30 minute drive, which would allow a truck driver at a port that has a drop in pick time of, say, an hour or two, that would allow a driver to do, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 turns a day. The industrial real estate in those regions, they are it's at 2% or less vacancy rate. And when you look at those distribution centers operated by the retailers, from medium size to ultra large, there is no room at the end. They are completely full to the point where a lot of them have rented trailers to put in their truck parking lots to store goods. And some of them are hanging on to their international boxes sitting on chassis for long periods of time, an increase of somewhere between 3 to 12 days over what it used to be.
Sure.
Which again is draining on our equipment shortage, but it also tells you something interesting. We can't get the freight, the cargo from the port cities to rural locations fast enough. Because how can you have a level of inventories that's so low that you look back 4 or 5 years to see one where inventories last at this level and then have such a shortage of space, such high inventories at the ports? And what that data tells you is we have a problem getting stuff from the port cities to rural or internal locations in the United States.
Okay.
And when you look at the railroads, they've had, you know, they've been measuring the number of rail cars waiting to get into rail yards, international rail yards, the ones that handle international trains, measured in miles. I remember about early September, right? We were talking about 45 miles of rail cars waiting to get into the center point location in in Illinois, near Chicago, at Joliet. So we don't have enough rail capacity to meet this. And when it comes to the trucks, there we have a serious problem. In 2019, the American Trucking Association was, you know, pointing out that we had a shortage of over-the-road or long-haul truck drivers.
Yes.
And now it seems to be worse. And in August, the data for drug testing showed a 13% jump in the number of truck drivers who tested positive for drugs. And what was scary is that 90% of those who tested positive did not go to a return-to-work program. They just chose to give up their license.
Sure.
At least for that month. So whatever shortage we had has been worsened by events such as the drug testing plus higher retirement rates. And if you want to put your finger on what the fundamental problem is for the ports, for the number of ships sitting at harbor, or the congestion at the port cities, it's the fact that we don't have enough truck drivers to move stuff from the port cities to anywhere else in the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, big problem that it really is not going away, to say the least.
No, definitely. So, a friend of mine, Rick Abelson, who is the chairman of the Advisory Committee on Supply Chain Competitiveness to the Secretary of Commerce, he's been a member of that for a long time. I joined that committee some years after he started working in it. So he had recommended about 6-7 weeks ago that we consider using military truck drivers to help out. And, I saw some comments from people in the trucking industry who felt kind of threatened by that, and they really shouldn't be. We just need to get additional drivers, into the system to help out a bit. Because, truck driver wages are up a lot. They're earning a lot of money. But basically what you're having right now is an increase in price and a reduction in service and capacity at the same time. So this is detrimental to the economy. It's the kind of thing that if we don't fix could result in very negative effects on the economy going forward.
Yeah.
And I think this is probably, I think this is the best idea I've heard since the pandemic began.
Okay. Well, I mean, do you think that it has a decent chance of coming to fruition in terms of getting military staff to help out? I know that there was a piece in, I believe, yesterday's Washington Post about that very topic. And I believe President Biden made some comments about that last night, if I'm not mistaken, as well.
I think you're correct. I was traveling last night, got in late, so I missed that part of the news flow. But so there's two kinds of drivers. You have the, National Guard, and you also have, the guys who are full-time, Army, Navy, et cetera. I think for the other military drivers who are not in the National Guard, we'll have to check the rules very carefully because the Department of Defense has, been obviously very careful about, procurement and making sure that, the system is used properly. And so that may take a little bit of bobbing and weaving to make happen. Otherwise, we'll have to very quickly pass a bill in Congress that would allow this to work.
Okay, interesting. And, you had touched upon the ports, obviously. In the news last week, especially, a lot was made about efforts underway at both the Port of Los Angeles and the Port of Long Beach to make the move to 24/7 operations to increase efficiency, throughput, get all those vessels that are at anchor outside waiting to get into berths. What are the prospects there? Do you think this can work? Is it a good approach? I mean, there's a lot of questions about this.
Yeah. Well, I think there's some confusion, especially when I hear some government officials speak. The port directors, who are very influential, obviously, in their port, do not operate the terminals. The terminals are operated by terminal operators.
Yes.
For example, SSA. You can say you're going to operate 24/7, but the reality is you need the terminal operators to operate 24/7. And I haven't seen comments from them in the press. I have spoken with one or two, but it's not my business to talk about their business in public. Right. But it's probably a very good idea to go speak with them directly and see what can be done. I'm not 100% sure that you can go to 24/7 in Southern California completely across the board, simply because it's been difficult to train new workers. You've had workers who have been ill with coronavirus. Some of them have died, sadly. Some of them, I believe, have retired. So you're dealing with probably a smaller workforce. And so it remains to be seen whether or not all of the 13 terminals in the San Pedro Bay complex could actually, operate on a 24/7 basis. But even if they did, the question is, do you have enough local truck drivers? I think we do, but I'm not sure they are willing to come and pick up stuff in the middle of the night on a Sunday to take to a distribution center, because the distribution center may not be open.
Mm-hmm.
And I did read that some of the big importers said that they would operate their distribution centers on a 24/7 basis, but if they don't have any room at the end, then I don't think that will happen. And what I'm hearing around the country in virtually every port that handles containers is that they are sitting with more containers in their container yards right now than at any other time in the past. So a lot of these importers are just simply not bringing stuff to their distribution centers, which I think is because there's no room at the distribution centers. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, then you can operate 24/7. It's not going to work. What you're stuck with, again, is you need truck drivers to take stuff from the distribution centers at the ports to interior locations. Make some room at the local end so that you can get the stuff off of the ports.
Yeah, no question about it.
And Jeff, let me just add something here. And in speaking with terminal operators, and we won't say whom and where, but in many places I have heard that the containers are occupying so much room that they're encroaching on the area that you need in order to service the vessels, that it's a constant battle to get those boxes away from the apron.
Yeah. No question about it. Just in the time that we have left, Walter, I thought it'd be interesting just to get your thoughts. And it's something that we talked about, I think, one of the last times we spoke about the prospects for increasing domestic production. By production, I mean manufacturing, more commonly referred to as nearshoring or reshoring, in the hope that maybe it could increase trade flows, prevent some delays, things along those lines. What are the prospects for that? It's something that we always hear about, but we just never really see a lot of action, it seems like.
Yeah, actually, we are seeing action, Jeff, finally, but it's mostly subsidized by the U.S. government. But basically, anything related to healthcare, whether it's, equipment like, glucose meters for diabetics, whether it's crutches, whether it's PPE for the medical guys, we want all of that, as well as the pharmaceutical ingredients. We want those manufactured in the U.S.,
Yes.
And we are seeing chemical companies now open new divisions called Chemical Companies, Company X Pharmaceutical. And that is being subsidized by the U.S. government. And I emphasize subsidized because there's a lot of claim that, manufacturing in the U.S. is cheaper. We should bring everything back. It's not cheaper. I work with a lot of companies that would love to manufacture in the U.S., but the problem is, the global middle class is not in the U.S. It's a few billion people who are mostly in Asia. And if you want to grow and service that market, you have to produce there. And from there, you can produce extra amounts and ship it to the small middle class in the United States and in Europe. Where our middle class has a lot of money to spend, but in terms of the number of people, it's much smaller. And so it's difficult to manufacturer in a country that has a tight labor supply like we do and high wages to other countries where there's a middle class that basically earns less on average than the average American. Okay. So see that happening except for where the subsidies occur. The other place you're seeing that is in technology. And Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation is opening a $12 billion fab in Arizona. My understanding is that there was a lot of support coming from the federal government. We want our chips made here. We don't want them made in other places, particularly where there is national interests that are not aligned with ours. So except for that, I think everything else is going to get shuffled. If people are importing goods from Asia, particularly from China, they should be shifting to Western Asia, like India, Vietnam, Indonesia, where you can get plenty of workers and low wages and no issues with the U.S. government. And I expect to see a lot more coming from Brazil, Colombia, Chile, Mexico into the U.S. So there's labor there, there's capability. And I think that's what we're going to see is redundancy in supply chains. Make more things in more places and bring them in through more ports than you have in the past.
Yeah.
And I think this is the way forward.
Yeah, no, great points. And just to wrap up, Walter, we just have a couple of minutes left here. Just simply, given all the moving parts and the different things that are happening within global supply chains, if you were to put on a forecaster's hat, so to speak, what would be the optimal situation for, say, a year from now? Do you think we'll still be mired in this current situation? Or at that point, will we maybe have worked through some of these issues?
Well, I think we're going to work through a lot of these issues. The only problem is that next June 30th, the ILWU contract expires. And predicting what happens is too difficult. But let's just say if the contract gets extended, the current one gets extended for another year or two or three, like it did before, then I think by the end of this second quarter, calendar quarter of next year, we'll be at a new normal.
Okay.
It'll be a lot more stable. Let's just put it that way. Depending on what happens on the West Coast, it could be an extension of the tumult, similar to what we saw in 2015. Added on top of the coronavirus chaos.
Okay. Interesting. Well, listen, Walter, that brings us to the end of our allotted time for today's podcast. On behalf of Logistics Management Magazine, as well as the Peerless Media Supply Chain Group, I'd like to offer up a big thank you for joining us today.
More than happy to do that. Good speaking with you, Jeff.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those of you listening in, please feel free to check out Walter's website, the Kemsey Group. It's www.kemseysgroup.com. That's KEMMSIES group.com. And for those of you on Twitter, please go ahead and give us a follow at LogisticsMGMT. And also, please feel free to subscribe to our podcast, Supply Chain 24/7, wherever you get your podcast. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day, and we'll catch up with you next time.